artillery fire targeted a tent housing displaced people near the southern city of Khan Yunis, killing a child. Three civilians were also killed in a strike on a crowded area north of Rafah in southern Gaza. Three Palestinians were also killed in a drone strike in Gaza City. Since mid-March, Israel's renewed aggression has killed over 1,000 Palestinians and injured more than 2,500. UNICEF says the figure includes more than 320 children, which means nearly 100 children killed or maimed in just 10 days. The overall death toll is nearing 50,400, with about 114,600 others injured. The United Nations has rejected Israel's claim that there is sufficient food supplies in the besieged Gaza Strip. This after the World Food Program reported that the closure of all its bakeries across the territory. The world body's reaction followed the regime's claim that despite the ban on aid entry to Gaza, there is enough food for a long period of time. UN spokesman Stephane Dujarric dismissed Israel's allegation as ridiculous, adding that UN supplies in Gaza are almost finished. He emphasized that the World Food Program has closed its bakeries due to lack of flour and fuel. Meanwhile, head of the Gaza Bakery Association was quoted by local media as saying that all bakeries in Gaza have indefinitely ceased their operations due to a critical shortage of flour and fuel. The official described the current situation as an ongoing hunger war. Since March the 2nd, Israel has not allowed any aid to be delivered into Gaza, saying the ban will continue until Hamas releases all the remaining captives.
The Gaza Strip is facing a severe humanitarian crisis as Israeli blockade, now exceeding a month, continues to prevent the entry of essential aid, including food, fuel, and medical supplies.
The Gaza Strip is going through the most dire circumstances ever. The famine is back again, even more severely, as 25 bakeries stop completely. This current crisis is unprecedented, as this is the longest time span of closure of the Gaza crossings by the Israeli regime. This in turn has caused the shortage of flour and fuel needed for the bakeries to operate.
The United Nations World Food Programme reported that all bakeries in Gaza have ceased operations due to the acute shortages of flour and fuel. The WFP emphasized that bread, often the only accessible food for many families, is becoming unattainable, warning that famine is a serious risk looming for the Gazan population. The dire humanitarian crisis is further exacerbated by the continuous Israeli military aggression that not only claims the lives of thousands but also makes survival for 2.2 million Gazans a struggle.
As the blockade endures, the people of Gaza continue to face an increasingly desperate struggle for survival, with starvation looming as a significant threat. Besides the continuous Israeli aggressive attacks, Ghad Ibrahim, Gaza City.
Israeli forces and settlers continue their violent raids on towns and cities across the occupied West Bank, injuring more Palestinians and damaging their property. In one of the latest incursions, three Palestinians were injured by Israeli settlers in the town of Douma, south of Nablus. Hundreds of settlers who were protected by the regime's forces also burned two livestock farms and three vehicles. Three Palestinians were shot with live and rubber-coated steel bullets during confrontations that ensued the attack. In a separate incident, a group of extremist settlers attacked the Al-Uja Spring in the northern Ariha under protection of Israeli forces, injuring four Palestinian citizens. The settlers attacked Palestinians with pepper spray before closing the spring area, claiming it was a military zone. Violent attacks by Israeli forces and settlers on Palestinians have greatly increased in the West Bank following the resumption of the regime's genocide in Gaza. Our West Bank correspondent Naga Hamed joined us earlier for an update on the latest Israeli raids across the occupied Palestinian territory. Let's take a listen.
The Israeli settlers attacked Palestinians inside Al-Uja area near Ariha, where Palestinian families were just simply having having a holiday, but unfortunately the Israeli settlers attacked Palestinians over there, among many injuries occurred after being hit with rocks and after being sprayed on with poisonous pepper spray inside Al-Uja. The IOF actually came and intruded and arrested many Palestinians in the area. Also, the Israeli settlers have attacked the village of Douma to the south of Nablus. The village of Douma has been subjected to unbelievable and such large attacks upon this small village. As local resources have reported that there have been many cars and homes have been burned down inside Douma, with three Palestinians were injured during these clashes and during this violent attack by the Israeli settlers. So the situation from the Israeli settlers today, we have seen escalation by these attacks from the Israeli settlers, who are trying to expand and to expel Palestinians with all resources possible.
Iran has strongly condemned Israel's continued aggression against Lebanon, including Tuesday's deadly airstrike, which killed many civilians, including a Hezbollah official and his son. The foreign ministry spokesman said the regime has breached a ceasefire agreement with Lebanon over 2,000 times and violated the country's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Ismail Baghaei described Israel's aggression as a blatant violation of international law and human rights. He said the inaction of the ceasefire guarantors in the face of Israel's rogue behavior proves their promises lack any credibility. He also slammed the silence of international organizations, especially the UN Security Council, on Israel's heinous crimes in Lebanon and the occupied Palestine. Baghaei said the US and its Western allies are complicit in Israel's crimes, calling on regional countries to take more serious action to oppose the regime's expansionist policy. We earlier talked to political analyst Bruno Biclini to get his insight on Israel's constant violations of the ceasefire deal with Lebanon. Let's take a listen.
All the guarantors of the ceasefire, they kind of act as hypocrites, because Israel must be punished. If they violate the ceasefire, they would have to receive, for example, blockade and sanctions with the SWIFT system and all of the financial system controlled by the guarantors. As long as U.S. does not put pressure on Israel, and will never do this, we understand that the Arab nation and the Muslim countries, they must defend themselves. I have even more another thing to say. I'm very disappointed, but it's not a surprise, with the so-called Lebanese army and Lebanese armed forces, because I said this in this channel, on this television. As far as the Lebanese forces, they are down south, and they will have the duty to protect the civilians and to expose the invaders. As long as they don't fight against the Zionist army, they force Hezbollah to get into the conflict again. And that's exactly what's happening now. Tel Aviv understands that every target is legitimate if they allow them to be a Hezbollah base or a Lebanese resistance base. And during this time, the Lebanese forces, they do almost nothing. It's the same old situation in Lebanon. And the guarantors, as long as they don't punish Israel, what are they doing and what do they serve?
The Yemeni army says it has carried out a fresh anti-U.S. operation targeting an American aircraft carrier in the Red Sea for the third time in the past 24 hours.
In response to the American aggression against our country, the naval forces, rocket forces, and the air force of our armed forces have targeted hostile warships in the Red Sea, including the American aircraft carrier USS Harry S. Truman, using several cruise missiles and drones. The engagement is ongoing at the time of this statement, marking the third such operation in the past 24 hours. Our military operations against the American enemy will continue, targeting their warships in the declared operational zone with increasing intensity, God willing.
Saudi added that Yemen's operations against Israel will also continue by preventing navigation of the regime's vessels in the Red and Arabian Seas and targeting its military and vital facilities. He has stressed that anti-Israel operations will go on until the regime's genocide against the oppressed Palestinians in the Gaza Strip stops and the siege of the territory is lifted. The United States has carried out fresh airstrikes on various areas across Yemen to make the Arab country stop its support for Palestinians in Gaza. In their latest aggression, American warplanes conducted 5 airstrikes on the Yemeni capital Sana'a. The United States also carried out 5 air raids on Sa'ada Governorate after an earlier strike on Hodeidah. The strike on Hodeidah Governorate hit the water company in the city of Al-Mansouria, leaving 4 people dead and several others injured. Yemen's Hadja Governorate was another target of U.S. airstrikes, where American warplanes hit the Washa district with 3 raids. Most of U.S. attacks target civilian buildings in the Yemeni capital. Washington claims the attacks are meant to protect freedom of navigation in nearby waters. Yemen rejects the claim, saying its naval operations solely target Israel-linked ships in an attempt to stop the regime's genocide in Gaza. Iran's foreign minister has dismissed U.S. President Donald Trump's latest threats about using military force to bomb the country's nuclear sites. Abbas Araghchi asserted that there is no such thing as a military option, let alone a military solution with regard to Iran's peaceful nuclear program. He noted that although the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the 2015 nuclear agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, Iran has been committed to the deal. The top diplomat said that there is not one shred of proof that Iran has violated its commitment under the nuclear agreement. Araghchi said Iran has reaffirmed that under no circumstances will it ever seek, develop, or acquire nuclear weapons. He also cautioned against any U.S. adventurism, saying catastrophic failures in the region have cost prior U.S. administrations more than $7 trillion. Araghchi concluded by saying that diplomatic engagement has worked in the past and can still work. His remarks followed a phone call with the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, during which he called on the UN nuclear agency to take a clear stance on threats made against Iran's nuclear sites. Iran is celebrating the 46th anniversary of the establishment of the Islamic Republic, defining moment in its modern history. With a focus on independence, regional peace, and progress, the occasion marks a proud commemoration of one of Iran's most significant milestones. Gisum Shahmadi has more.
The Islamic Republic of Iran. Three words that mark one of the most significant milestones in the country's history. Islamic Republic Day, celebrated on April the 1st, commemorates the referendum that established this new governing system, ushering in a new era, endorsed by 98.2% of the voters, as defined by its late founder Imam Khomeini. Islamic Republic, not a word more, not a word less. 46 years later, the sentiments remain just as strong. Islamic Republic Day embodies one of the key slogans of the 1979 revolution chanted by masses: independence, freedom, and Islamic Republic. And today, a new generation remains committed to honoring this legacy, preserving the values that have shaped the nation's identity.
I was born after the revolution in the 1980s, and I believe that for us, it brought positive change. I will always stand by and support the Islamic Republic.
The Islamic Republic is the legacy handed down to us by our fathers. It is our duty to honor and protect this legacy so that it may be passed on to future generations.
The establishment of the Islamic Republic did not come easily. Many martyrs sacrificed their lives for us to have it, and it is our responsibility to safeguard it.
But Islamic Republic Day is more than just a national celebration. It highlights Iran's role as a beacon of hope for oppressed nations around the world.
The Islamic Republic is not merely a political system. It is a school of thought and a dialogue with the primary goal of creating justice. Its foundation lies in supporting oppressed people, above all the Palestinian people.
This is why the day serves as a reminder to Iranians of unity and solidarity that extends far beyond the nation's borders.
Iranians are marking the anniversary of the Islamic Republic with national pride, reaffirming their commitment to regional peace and progress towards a brighter future. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
On behalf of our team, thank you. We'll continue to bring you the latest. Stay safe and bye-bye for now.
east to west. Throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio.
Spring of Souls. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. After 1 month of fasting, worship and supplication, we are tasting the sweetness of Eid al-Fitr, Feast of Fitr, and the last days of Nowruz Feast. Now we are going to dwell upon Eid al-Fitr ceremonies and customs in different countries. Stay tuned, please. Eid al-Fitr, which indicates the end of the blessed month of Ramadan, is accompanied with various customs in different regions of the Islamic world. As you know, the first day of the Islamic month of Shawwal is called Eid al-Fitr, or Fitr Feast in Islam. It is a feast to indicate that God is rewarding His servants for obeying His command to fast in the month of Ramadan. The word Fitr means breaking in Arabic, and it means to break your fast. Muslims all over the world celebrate this auspicious day with different customs. In Iran, people wear clean clothes and hand out sweets and pastries to show their happiness. People in Mashhad go to the holy shrine of Imam Reza, peace be upon him, to celebrate the event there. Some people prepare ash, special kind of broth, and serve it among others after performing the Eid prayer. This is very customary among Iranians as a votive. People in the southwest of the country, like Khuzestan province, hold Eid al-Fitr with interesting customs. Young people pay a visit to their parents and the elderly, and they celebrate the Eid with Yazle. Yazle is a special custom in which young and old men gather together and beat their feet on the ground while reading poems. Now let us get familiar with the customs of Eid al-Fitr in some other Islamic countries. In Lebanon, Muslims visit their parents and relatives and congratulate them on the occasion of Eid al-Fitr. They prepare sweets with walnut, pistachio, and date. In Turkey, Eid al-Fitr is known as Şeker Bayrami, sugar feast, due to consumption of a lot of sugar in sweets and pastries. The people in Turkey clean their houses and prepare sweets and pastries a few days before Eid al-Fitr. Muslims of Egypt celebrate this great feast with recitation of poems and holding athletic games like horse riding. Hala bihalal is a beautiful custom among Indonesians during Eid al-Fitr. This custom means peace and reconciliation, which is held in the mosques of Indonesia. People visit their family, elders, or colleagues to show them respect and forgive each other. In India, after performing the congregational Eid prayers, the eldest among the family stays at home and waits for relatives and friends to visit them. The younger ones visit the elders with flower wreaths and stay with them till afternoon. The beautiful tradition of exchanging gifts is very customary in Pakistan on the occasion of Eid al-Fitr. People prepare special foods and edibles, and fathers give gifts to their children. Husbands also give gifts to their wives. Slaughtering livestock and distributing it among the people is common in the villages of Yemen during Eid al-Fitr. Moreover, different foods and sweets are also prepared on this occasion. In New Zealand, Muslims gather together and hold various banquets. They give presents and eat traditional foods with each other. These were just part of the traditions and customs of Muslims in a number of countries on the occasion of the great Islamic feast, Eid al-Fitr. May God accept the worships of every faithful and help them overcome their enemies, especially the Zionist regime and the U.S.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, think of others. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z with me, Sister Zainab, on IB English Radio. And so the title for today is Think of Others, and I'm recording this. I'm also going to be using this to refer to some very beautiful akhlaq, one of our most famous martyrs, one of our recent martyrs, and some beautiful recommendations he would give. So I'm talking about His Eminence the Sayyid. So the Sayyid, for example, was very concerned not to hurt people, not to upset, not to grieve other people and other believers. So people and believers, just everyone, basically. So some of the things, for example, he would do, and this is I'm highlighting this because obviously when we look to our martyrs, we draw some of our best lessons of akhlaq, because we look at them and we see, so this is how they behaved. These are the things they said. This is how they were thinking about other people, behaving towards other people. And this is really what we need to emulate. So the Sayyid would, for example, advise his children not to drive a car that provokes people. But that obviously meant but not driving a car that is too ostentatious, because obviously if we're driving a car that is ostentatious, that looks as if it was really expensive, there will be people who maybe look at it and maybe just feel a little bit upset on the inside, because there's no way they'll ever have anything like that. He would also, another recommendation he would give the family, for example, his children, would be to be very careful who we associate ourselves with. So this would be, for example, just in general, our relations with people, and especially, of course, when it comes to our actual companions, when it comes to our friendships with people. So he would advise people against associating with those who have a bad reputation. And obviously we know this in Islam, that we have to be very careful who we make our friends. We're supposed to choose our fellow believers as our friends. We're not supposed to, for example, take non-believers as our friends. But look, I'll explain that a bit more. Welcome back. This is A to Z and RB English Radio. And so obviously I'm talking about topic is thinking of others, being considerate towards others. And by that I mean, obviously I'm using the example of His Eminence the Sayyid, and some of the recommendations he would give to his family, to his children, that we have to be very careful in how we conduct ourselves, that our actions, the things we sort of show to the rest of the world, to the public, are, you know, they're chosen wisely, so we don't offend a believer's heart, we don't upset people, we don't make them feel bad because they are poor and we are somehow behaving or showing things that lead people to think we're rich and so on. So obviously in general, he would not tolerate inappropriate actions or behaviors. And obviously there's so many concepts just in these few little things I've highlighted from some of the, let's say, the akhlaq that was really important to him. So I'm talking about things such as humility, obviously. So even if, for example, someone in the family can afford an expensive car or a big house, if we want to be the best believers, if we really want to not hurt people, then obviously we should not then amongst, let's say, a village, if we're in a, let's say a village, because obviously he would have grown up in a village. We don't have the biggest house, a really expensive-looking house, because not everyone in the village would be able to afford that. So in a sense, it's this idea, well, we just have what's enough. We just show what is enough. We don't display. We're not ostentatious. We're not excessive, and we're always thinking about, you know, just sort of being average, basically. And so we're always thinking about, we're always being empathetic towards others. We're always caring towards others. And obviously, at the root of this is piety. At the root of this is just being wanting to be the best servant of Allah. So, inshallah, you've gained just a few extra points from this and just a reminder of the beautiful akhlaq of our martyrs. And I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of HZT on IB English Radio. And farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Islamic Republic Day. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. The Islamic Revolution in Iran triumphed on February 11, 1979. Less than 2 months after this greatest event of the 20th century, Imam Khomeini called on people to take part in a referendum to determine the type of the system of government. Therefore, on 30th and 31st of March, the nationwide referendum was held and over 98.2% of the participants voted yes to Islamic Republic as the ruling system in the country. Thus, April 1st was named as the Islamic Republic Day in the Iranian calendar. This way of determination and formation of the ruling system has not had any precedent in history, even in the so-called democratic societies in the West. In view of the fact that the Iranian nation is a Muslim nation and had struggled for Islam for decades, especially with the leadership of Imam Khomeini, some officials and analysts maintain that there was no need to hold a referendum, but the Imam
insisted on a clear and public referendum. The founder of the Islamic Republic said in his message to the Iranian nation, "This referendum will determine the fate of our nation. This referendum will either draw you to freedom and independence or, like before, to suffocation and dependence on others. This referendum is what everyone should participate in it. You can choose any form that you want. You have the right and you're able to write on this paper, democratic republic, royal regime, or whatever you want. You are free in this." On this great day, the faithful Iranian people demonstrated their national unity and Islamic solidarity with their decisive vote to fortify the bases of the Islamic Revolution. They altered the history of mankind with their faithful election. The Iranian people dismantled a long history of despotism, oppression, and disgraceful colonialism for good. The Islamic Republic has been the most democratic system of government in the past centuries, far superior to the democratic rule which has been claimed and propagated for decades by higher thinkers and writers in the West. The Islamic Republic is built up of two parts, Islam and people. That's why the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, insists of calling it religious popular rule rather than the man-made flawed Western democracy, which has proved its deficiency and even contradiction with the votes of people. The establishment of the Islamic Republic not only proved the Iranian nation's will on their fate, but it also inspired hope in the hearts of the oppressed and downtrodden in the world. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, called April 1st as a feast and said in a message, "The morning of April 1st, which is the first day of Allah's rule, is one of our greatest religious and national feasts. Our nation should hold on this day as feast and keep it alive." Ayatollah Khamenei also said, "There is another feature in our Islamic Republic Day, namely, it is not the feast of us, the Iranian people. Rather, it can be the feast of all those who are Muslims. It means nearly 1 billion people. They, meaning the Muslim nations, have also got used to seeing Islam in the state of defense and passive position, in the state of isolation. When a nation stands in the position of attacking domineering powers and aggressive, incomplete man-made systems and proclaims a republic on the basis of Islam, this is a cause of boasting and honor for Muslim nations. In short, there are various features in the Islamic Republic Day." Clearly, the formation of the Islamic Republic system in Iran created a new theory among the political theories of the East and the West. Article 56 of Iran's constitution reads, "Absolute rule over the world and human being belongs to God, and it is He who has made human being ruler of his social fate. Nobody can dispossess human being of this divine right or put it at the service of the interest of a special individual or group. And the nation wields this God-given right in the ways that will come in the next articles." The establishment of the Islamic Republic system in Iran, besides domestic developments, caused different changes in the region and the world, which were not compliant with the unholy goals of the colonialist powers. In view of this, the enemies of Islam and the Iranian nation hatched various plots to topple this system. These plots began since the first days of the victory of the Islamic Revolution and escalated after the formation of the Islamic Republic. They included the imposition of an 8-year war, assassination of political, religious, and revolutionary figures and officials, economic sanctions, creation of barriers on the way of achieving peaceful nuclear energy, assassination of scientists of nuclear field and commanders of the resistance front, and kindling riots in a number of cities. Now, the Islamic Revolution has already started the second phase of its life. The leader of the Islamic Revolution says, "Why has the Islamic Republic not suffered the destiny of other systems and revolutions despite this much of enmity? What is the reason and the mystery? I tell you that the splendid and honorable mystery of this system and the durability of this system are these two words, Republic and Islamic. The accompanying of these two words with one another, and the creature that has been formed of these two words, should naturally be permanent. Both the Republic and the Islamic, people and Islam. Republic means people, and Islamic means Islam, religious, popular rule. The feat of our great Imam was that he created this thought, this theory. The theory of the Islamic Republic brought it among various political theories, as in that era, different political theories were in contact with each other in the East and the West in the field of political issues and political mentalities. He materialized it, realized it. It was not merely the creation of a theory, but he materialized it and created the Islamic Republic system. This was the Imam's feat."
Sorba International Media Festival.
Part 1.
In an era where mainstream media often glosses over the intricacies of our world, documentary filmmakers play a crucial role in revealing deeper truth. Today, we have the privilege of speaking with a distinguished filmmaker and producer whose body of work includes several significant documentaries that have not only informed but also inspired audiences, a man whose commitment to uncovering untold stories and presenting them with authenticity has made his work distinguished. I am Bahman Nouri, your host, and this is another episode of SOAP.
Murtaza Shahbani, born in 1964 in Iran, is a distinguished cinematographer and film producer. He began his career in the film industry in 1994 and has since worked on notable projects such as Abu Zainab, Curse My Little Homeland, and Woman with Gunpowder Earrings. Shahbani is known for his collaboration with prominent artists like Carmen Lebes, Bassem Magnia, Omar Shalk, and Yusuf Haddad. His expertise and dedication have earned him recognition in the Iranian film industry.
Mr. Murtaza Shahbani, very good to have you on the show.
Hello to you and the dear audience. Thank you for having me on your show.
It is indeed a pleasure for us to have you here. What inspired you to become a documentary filmmaker?
I've never wanted to be a documentary filmmaker from the start. My main job was photography, and I loved it. I started photography when I was in high school, and later on I was introduced to a group of documentary filmmakers named Chronicles of Victory and began working with them. Images were my real interest, and I wanted to be a film photographer and take photos. After my dear friend Morteza Avini was honored as a martyr, out of necessity and responsibility, I took it upon myself to continue his legacy. That's why I ended up being a documentary filmmaker, but photography is still my main interest. I never really gave it up, and I do some photography and videography, with the latest being the Lebanon conflict. In fact, I was both the videographer and producer of the documentary. I've never lost interest in images.
That is very interesting. Your friendship with Marty Morteza Avini. Tell us how you met, because he's like a philosopher of cinema. How you guys met? Tell us about this friendship.
Actually, I met him in 1986. One of my friends introduced me to the Chronicles of Victory documentary filmmakers of Iran television. My first day of work was really interesting. I was waiting in the broadcasting center until noon. I didn't recognize Morteza Avini, but I saw a man about 40 years old go to the front and lead the prayer. I'd heard Morteza's voice on TV before, and that's when I realized he was Morteza Avini, the producer, director, and voice actor of Chronicles of Victory with his unique voice.
This brings me to your book, The Last Narrative. How was the feeling of writing about the life and legacy of such a close friend?
Honest to God, the moments I had with him were the best moments of my life. I can't even imagine trading these moments for anything else. So I decided to write them down as memories and experiences. The new generation should get familiar with Avini's life and attitude, so I tried to write about the part of my life when I was working with him. Besides, losing a great man like Morteza Avini was a great tragedy for Holy Defense Cinema. I was the videographer at that time, and I was accompanying him on that trip. I was there when he became a martyr. I really wanted to document this part of my life in a book, so I began writing it for the readers. A little after his martyrdom, I started writing the memories of my last trip. One of the newspapers published a summary of one part of it. It was a pity to leave it just like that until 2 years ago, when one of the great publishers encouraged me to complete the book, which was titled The Last Chronicle. After that, I included the part about the memories of Khorramshahr under the title A City in the Skies. Actually, I kind of felt this was a burden on my shoulders, and I had to do this. The book was showcased at the book fair this year.
Well, this recount of victory that you made with Morteza Avini, tell us about this experience. It was such a real, such a tangible narrative of the years of war.
There is a difference between usual filmmaking and the filmmaking of the Holy Defense period. As far as those who are concerned with ideology, they might seem the same. But at that time, we didn't really care about what we were doing. We just did what we knew and were good at, not as filmmakers or videographers, but as soldiers. We were the same as those soldiers who were fighting in the trenches. They were holding arms and we were holding cameras. We dressed like them and shared the same living conditions. This was the memorable experience of war. The question normally arises, why didn't Avini use closing credits in his works, and why didn't he mention the names of the contributors? He wanted to show that we were working in the same situation as those nameless heroes who were fighting. So there was no need to mention any names, as we were like those soldiers. We can't make a distinction between filmmaking and Holy Defense, because filmmaking is a remarkable aspect of war. As Murtaza Arvini put it, a documentary filmmaker is like a mirror reflecting the subject matters that face him, and he should reflect them exactly as they are with true honesty for the people. Mr. Arvini is well known all around the world for being the architect of these kinds of distinctive films.
This is indeed a very interesting conversation, Mr. Murtaza Shahbani. Thank you for staying with us, and thank you for waiting. We'll be back shortly. Indeed, he was such a transcending character in all manners of life, in all walks of life. Indeed, he was very impressive. You mentioned that you traveled to Lebanon. I'm going to talk about moving on a few years after the war. You had a project on Imam Musa Sadr, and you traveled to Lebanon, where you actually met for the very first time with the late Marty Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. Tell us about that experience, that first-hand experience of meeting Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah.
Around 32 years ago, I had my first trip to Lebanon. We were supposed to make a documentary film about Imam Musa Sadr. That's when I met Mr. Hassan Nasrallah for the first time. It was really fascinating for me, the man himself and the circumstances in which I met him. He was an important figure and had been listed on Israel's terror list for a long time, so there were specific security procedures to pass. I interviewed him about Imam Musa Sadr. He considered himself to be Sadr's apprentice, viewing Sadr as his role model in life. A few years later, in 2000, when the Israelis were forced to retreat from the south of Lebanon, we went there and made a documentary film titled Bitter Olive. We arranged a meeting with the Jihad deputy of Hezbollah for this documentary. We were sitting at a conference table in a big hall when a young man around 37 years old entered with a handgun and greeted us. We didn't take him seriously at first. Then he introduced himself as the Jihad deputy of Hezbollah. He was Imad Mourniyeh. This was the first time we met him. We explained everything about our goal for this documentary, which was to cover the operation that caused the Israelis to retreat from Lebanon. He introduced us to the major commanders of Hezbollah and provided us with all the things we needed. We conducted some investigations and had another meeting with Hassan Nasrallah and Imad Mourniyeh. That was a heartfelt, friendly meeting that I will never forget. During this meeting, I explained about 8 documentaries that we plan to make, and he proposed 2 other ideas for the documentary films. One of these was made, titled Ansariya. Ansariya is a village located in the south of Lebanon, close to the sea. The Israelis were determined to kidnap high-ranking Hezbollah commanders from this village with their 16 best men. Hezbollah got informed about this and set an ambush for them. Only one of these 16 Israelis managed to escape. It was a complicated operation. Abu Zainab is another fascinating documentary that I made a movie about. Abu Zainab conducted an operation on the Israeli border and killed many Israeli soldiers. The house of Amer Kalakesh, his real name, was located in the occupied territories. Israel had control over this territory before 2000. The mother concealed her son's martyrdom from the family for 14 years and only told her daughter. The father didn't know that his son had been martyred. They told him that Amer was working in Kuwait and his sister wrote letters and put some money in the letterbox on behalf of her brother to make things seem normal for the father. The sacrifice of this mother was intended to keep the other family members safe. After the victory in 2000, Hassan Nasrallah made a speech and revealed the real name of Abu Zainab, which was Amer Kalakesh. We made a documentary about this incident. The movie was released in 2015 with Ali Ghaffari serving as a director and I as the producer.
Mr. Murtaza Shahbani, it was such a learning experience spending this time with you. I don't know, I did not even notice how time passed. Thank you for coming to the show.
Thank you for having me on your show.
And thank you for staying with us with another soap. Until next time, it's goodbye from me, Behman Uray.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. Welcome to another enlightening episode of Islamic Upbringing, where we dive deep into the essential aspects of nurturing your youth in line with Islamic teachings. In this program, our discussions are rooted in the guidance of the Holy Quran and the timeless wisdom of Hadith from our beloved Prophet Muhammad, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his purified family, and the insightful narratives of our noble Imams. I'm glad to have with us today Brother Muhammad Liaquat Abbas, a research scholar from the Seminary of Qom, who possesses a wealth of knowledge in both Islamic studies as well as psychology. So, Brother Liaquat Abbas, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam, sister.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you so much.
One of the things that is so common in the teens is that they start comparing themselves with others, and then they feel discontent with themselves. Yes, we're going to discuss dissatisfaction and discontent in teens. And Brother Liaquat Abbas is here to help us through, and he'll tell us the solutions, what to do with these teens. And you may have seen like teens are so much unsatisfied with themselves. So be it the body image, like, because the body image concept is so much out there on social media today. It's telling you like there's this perfect, I don't know, so-called body, and they start comparing, be that on the television, be that with celebrities, or be that anywhere else. So, like, this is so common in teens. So what could be done and how to tackle this dissatisfaction?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So this is extremely common. Why? Because, of course, when it comes to body image, the teens are facing a lot of issue with this, because they want the perfect image of the body, a perfect face, a perfect color, skin tone, I mean, perfect skin tone, or perfect, hair color, perfect hair, like example, perfect hair with regards to it being curly or examples in a straightened manner. Example,
yeah.
Eye color, everything.
Everything, yeah.
Wearing clothes, shoes, example, when it comes to ladies like purse. And it goes ahead with like makeup, ornaments, jewelry, I don't know, nail polish and lipstick and stuff.
Yeah.
That side over here, sleeveless, shorts, I don't know, bike and everything. Yeah. So everything is mattering. Like, okay, so if I sit on this so-and-so bike, I'm going to look good. Okay. If I
it comes from elite family.
Yeah. Example, I'm going to impress other people. Example.
Yeah.
Okay. And how am I dressing up is very important. Unfortunately, many teens, like there are millions and millions of teens who feel insecure about their appearance,
mm-hmm.
unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
And when they compare it to the social influencers, so there are social people like on TikTok, be it on Insta, be it on social media websites. So they are hesitant in order to engage in social activities or wear certain clothes. So like when they have good clothes, the teens are like, okay, if I wear this, I might be outdated.
Yeah.
Okay? So they want new clothes to be brought, new things, new stuff to be brought by their parents in order to get upgraded with the going trend, example. Okay. So what's the solution example? The first thing is to get a break from the social media. This is the main thing.
Okay.
Like getting a break, which is very difficult, is very important. Why? Because this teen is addicted to social media. So everything is from there.
Yeah.
Okay. So get a break from social media. Don't go to those social influencers, those celebrities. Unfortunately, you know what? When it comes to psychology, there are many celebrities who have this disorder. Like they have disorders.
Okay.
Disorder of grandiosity. Like they want themselves to be shown. They want themselves to be praised. This is a kind of disorder.
Yeah.
Narcissism, what we say. Yeah. And there's another disorder called histrionic. Anyways, we don't want to go inside it. Where they want praise
attention,
to happen.
Praise,
so what they're
going
to do, they're going to apply a lot of lipstick, example. They're going to make their body shape in a perfect manner. Why?
Right.
Because they want a lot of praise.
Right. Yeah, let's take a short break here, and it's needed to ponder on these things, and we'll get back to you.
Give thanks to Allah for the moon and the stars. Praise Him all day for what is and what was. Take hold of your iman. Don't give in to Shaitan. Oh, you who believe, please give thanks to Allah. Allahu Ghafoor, Allahu Rahim, Allahu Yuhibbul Muhsinin, wa Khaliquna, wa Rasiquna, wa Huwa ala kulli shay'in qadeer.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Islamic Upbringing. Brother Liaquat is helping us with dissatisfaction. Well, we said that teens, when they compare themselves with the social media celebrities or anyone who looks like kind of so-called perfect apparently, and they have this discontent and dissatisfaction with their physical appearance. So how to help out these teens, especially like, because like we have girls, and when in Islam we are taught modesty and to be not to be showing off and not to be a center of attraction in that phase. We are facing a world when this has become a competition and this has become something that represents you, basically.
Yep. So these celebrities, even they go through a lot of surgeries in order to make their body like shape perfect.
Yeah.
Or example, in order to get proper
appearance.
Appearance with regards to face, with regards to teeth even. And they spend like thousands to like hundreds of thousands of dollars on this because there was a kind of